And I'll be leading the Bible study today, so you can start the tape. Anyway, my name's Esther Mann, and today's Bible study is called God's Multiculturalism, God is Cosmic Warrior. This whole week, I'm going to be talking about God's multiculturalism. It was a nice buzzword, and so I thought that I would use it for my title, since our theme for this year is A Whole New World, and since it celebrates, or at least recognizes, the coming into contact of cultures. And I thought that it would be interesting to look at a few images of God in the Bible, sometimes images that aren't very commonly used in our culture, but images which somehow relate to the larger cultural and literary context of the ancient Near East where they were produced. And the one that I chose for today is the cosmic warrior. I thought that by choosing a number of specific images, we could explore some of the literature of the ancient Near East that you usually don't hear about in church and so forth, since that's a different context. And so a lot of you probably don't know the literature that's been discovered in the last 100 years. So that's kind of a historical or literary interest. But also then I thought that it would be interesting to follow some of these images into the New Testament and to see how the writers, the authors of the New Testament, appropriated these images and then applied them to the life and the significance of Jesus as Christ. And then I thought as a third step that it would be interesting to follow these images into our present day. So a different cultural context, another meeting of cultures. And I'm going to leave most of that to you to talk about whether these images, today specifically the cosmic warrior image, is still resonates with us, if it's meaningful, if it's dangerous, where it's best applied, what aspects of it you find most moving, whether you think it is eclipsed, whatever. So anyway, those are kind of the three different areas that we'll talk about. So I'll probably be doing most of the talking during the first couple of sections, but I'll get people to read biblical passages and so forth. And if you ever notice something in your Bibles and your translations that's different and you want to ask a question about it, or if you want to ask questions or make comments during that section, please do. Yes? I'm very sensitive to the audience, so if you do raise your hand, I will call on you immediately. All right. Our starting point today is going to be Psalm 89. Now, this psalm, at least the first part of it, was a coronation hymn. Looks like for King David, or at least for one of David's descendants. And it legitimizes David's rule and the rule of the Davidic dynasty forever. So it's a psalm that has God actively involved in supporting a political institution. Now, the part that I want to concentrate on, it's a bit lengthy, the part that I want to concentrate on is the part that contains the image of the cosmic warrior. And so if someone would begin with verse 6 and go to verse 15. And if you could please tell us what translation you're using, just so that we can compare. Yes, please.
Revised Standard Version.
Thank you.
For who in the skies can be compared to the Lord? Who among the heavenly beings is like the Lord? A God filled in the council of the holy ones, great and terrible above all that round about him. O Lord God of hosts, who is mighty as thou art, O Lord, with thy faithfulness round about thee. Thou dost rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, thou stillest them. Thou didst crush Rahab like a carcass. Thou didst scatter thy enemies with thy mighty arm. The heavens are thine, the earth also is thine. the world and all that is in it, thou hast founded them. The north and the south, thou hast created them. The Bourne and Hermon.
Mm-hmm, those are two mountains.
Right. Joyously praise thy name. Thou hast a mighty arm, strong is thy hand, high thy right hand. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of thy throne. Steadfast love and faithfulness go before thee.
Thank you. Okay, so a lot of interesting things in this. This is an old hymn, piece of literature. In fact, it even seems to predate monotheism. Interesting, huh? Because, I usually think of the Bible, okay, the Bible is a record of the monotheistic faith. We believe in one God and so forth. But here and in some other psalms, we have images of a God who rules over a divine council. And so it kind of makes you see that plural, let us create man in our own image in a different light in the creation story. So this was, if this was composed for David's coronation, then it was around 1000 BC or so. So it is old. And you have the real first strong, sustained monotheistic voice, I think, in 2 Isaiah, which is much later, in the 6th century BC, where there is only one God, and everybody else who thinks there's another God, that's foolishness. But here, our God is the primary God, right? He's the first God among all gods. Okay, so here we have our King God being celebrated. Interesting, because you're also coronating the king, so you have the King God conferring power on the King of Israel, David. And notice now, it goes to this image of conflict in 10. It says, you rule the swelling of the sea when its waves... You rule the swelling of the sea. When its waves surge, you still them. You crush Rahab. He was like a corpse. With your powerful arm, you scattered your enemies. I have the translation, which is called Tanakh, the Holy Scriptures. And this is a translation of the Old Testament, of the Hebrew Bible, the Bible that the Jewish people use. It's done by the Jewish Publication Society, and I find it to be very readable. So if you like translations of Bibles and you want a new one, this would be a good addition. And it is on sale in the bookstore. The reason I interrupted myself is I remembered I was instructed to tell you it is on sale in the bookstore. And very readable, so you might want to look into that. But anyway, as far as this image here, God fighting with the sea, and the waves are crashing, and God stills the waves. He crushes Rahab. Now Rahab in Hebrew means that seething action of the sea, so the power of the sea. So here you have an image of God controlling and defeating this power, sort of the sea as sort of an image of chaotic, tumultuous, uncontrollable power, and God is in control of it. And this is related to his status above, he's supreme among all the other members of the divine council because he has that kind of power, which is illustrated in this myth here. It's interesting then that it goes on and it talks about creation. After the stilling of the sea, talks about the heaven and earth as being God's, and also the world and all it holds. God's established them, created north and south, and the mountains. And they all sing. So this act of conquering the sea is connected with creation in this small section here. And finally, once again, it repeats. It repeats the proclamation of God's strength by talking about God's right arm. God's right arm is often the supreme symbol of God's strength also. And says that God's throne is established. So there's establishment of God's rule on the basis of righteousness and justice. Now, this is very brief, and if you were just to read this through, you might say, well, you know, what what sense does this make? This is a little bit confusing. But in the last 100 years, fragments and tablets and so forth have been uncovered in Mesopotamia in the Akkadian language, which is a language that's printed on clay with wedge-shaped marker. And it's really interesting. There's some literature which sheds some light on this very short passage. I want to recount for you a story. It's a very well-developed story. This is an English translation of it. And it goes into a lot more detail than this small section. But if you listen, you'll hear many of the same motifs. You'll find some things different, but you'll hear some of the same motifs. And I think you'll find it interesting to see that what we have in Psalm 89 is actually part of a larger narrative pattern that's found in other areas. Now, what I'm going to read to you is from ancient Babylon, the Old Kingdom of Babylon, which is approximately where Iraq is today. And it's probably from around 1500 BC. Okay, so I'll recount the story to you, and then I'll read you some of the more exciting parts for fun. Using illustrations here. In the beginning, there was nothing but one god named Tiamat, and she was the ocean water. She was salt water. And also her husband, her mate, Apsu. Now he was the fresh water. So the whole world was formless and without, void and without form, that kind of thing. Just watery chaos, as you have in Genesis also, actually. But here in the Akkadian version, in the Babylonian version, Tiamat, the salt water, mingles with Apsu, and their waters meet. And out of their waters, all the gods are generated. So you have the whole pantheon being created. And they keep mingling and keep mingling and mingling until finally there's so many gods all around and they're so loud that Apsu says, "This is enough. I can't sleep. They're noisy. They get all over the place. I'm going to kill them all." So he gets a commander. And they make their plans. But meanwhile, one of their sons, who's the wisest of all, his name is Ea, he hears about this plan, and he rallies the other gods, and they attack their father, and they kill him. Now, this is well and good for the gods, but Mom is mad because her husband's been killed, and so she starts raging, and she starts thinking about killing all the gods also. She's really angry. And the gods don't know what to do. With Dad, okay, they can knock him off, but when Mom starts really foaming, this is really chaos, and they're very afraid. They send somebody to try to cool her down. Doesn't work. They don't know what to do, but finally they appeal to another god named Marduk, who is Ea's son, and they say, "Will you please take on this monster, this sea monster?" And he says, "I'll do that, but the condition is that I have to be made king of all the gods. I have to rule all of you. Whatever comes from my mouth is law from now on. And I'm going to set up my temple in the capital city, and there I'm going to rule forever." And they say, "Fine, we don't care, because that would be great, because as long as you can get rid of this sea monster here who's out of control, and keep us alive, do it." So he takes her on. And then I was going to read you a few sections just to get a little feel for the way this is drawn out a bit more than in the biblical version. In the biblical version, you just have, when its waves surge, you still them and so forth. But here, Mom, Tiamat here, she's going crazy. She's screaming aloud, and her legs are shaking together and she's casting charms and spells, and the gods are all sharpening their battle knives. Then joined Ishu, Tiamat, and Marduk, wisest of gods. They strove in single combat, locked in battle. The Lord spread out his net to enfold her. The evil wind, which followed behind, he let loose in her face. Then Tiamat opened her mouth to consume him. He drove in the evil wind, that she closed not her lips. As the fierce winds charged her belly, her body was distended and her mouth was wide open. He released the arrow. It tore her belly. It cut through her inside, splitting the heart. Having thus subdued her, he extinguished her life. He cast down her carcass to stand upon it. And later, he takes her dead body, and he divides the monster. He splits it like a shellfish into two parts. Half of her he sets up as a ceiling, and half of her he puts down and posts guards and bathes the waters not to escape. So what he does in this part of the story is he splits her body, raises part of it up like this, and this is the old ancient Near Eastern modern model of the world. This is the world we live in. It's a bubble of air, and all around is water. That's why the sky is blue, because you can see the water up there. And when it rains, see, the windows are open a little bit, and then they close, that kind of thing. And also, down here, you just have water. That's why you have springs. So the whole world is just an air bubble. That's how the flood, you know, God opens the windows and the fountains of the deep, and, well, you're not going to live too much longer. Just a little bubble. So that's a common understanding of the world, the way the world is, and it's set on posts here. So he creates the world out of this dead monster. Interesting, because we have in Psalm 89, we have the creation of the world right after the conquest of the sea. Next what he does, and this is not in Psalm 89, but he takes Tiamat's commander-in-chief. She had appointed somebody to lead her forces, and he takes the dead body of this monster, Kingu, and out of the blood of this monster, he creates the human race. And he creates the human race to be slaves of the gods, to serve the gods, to offer them their daily meals in the temples and so forth. Now, this is, although we're not dealing with this directly, this is very interesting because it demonstrates a very different concept of human being, of the human being and the purpose of humanity than in the Bible, because here human beings are created to be slaves of the gods. In Genesis 1, if you remember, human beings are created to be like God, to have dominion over the world, to be kings with God. So you have a radically different concept of the purpose of human life in the Hebrew Bible and in the Babylonian myth. I prefer the Hebrew Bible, personally. But anyway, so out of this conflict then, the whole world is created, humankind is created. Also, then all the different constellations are set up. There's pages of the names of the constellations and which god lived in what constellation and so forth. And then finally, the temple of Marduk, which is going to be his dwelling place, from which he'll rule, is set up in Babylon, which is the capital of this militaristic empire. And there he rules. So this story then, it was read, the theory is that it was read every year at a New Year's festival, and it told about the creation of the world, but also legitimized and established the authority of the state. Because this had happened in the past, because Marduk had been able to overcome the power of this sea monster and create the world, therefore Marduk, living in Babylon, was in control, and of course the whole state system and the military had a legitimate right to be powerful and so forth. Okay, so this is the Babylonian story here. And you've probably noticed that if we go back to Psalm 89, you can see several of these same elements, the same sort of narrative. You have that idea of the supreme god doing battle with the sea, with the forces of the unruly sea, then the creation of the world and the establishment of the throne of the god. So now if you didn't have this ancient version, you know, you could find that same pattern, but you wouldn't know that it was actually partaking of a larger cultural narrative. Does anybody have, at this point, have any questions, comments, anything like this before I move on to the next point I'd like to make?
Within each culture, there are many myths, many stories.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, as researchers, as we look back at those different cultures, we pick out those that were in control, or those that had some influence at the time, correct?
Okay, so you're saying that there were probably more stories than this? But
there might be more myths, more mm-hmm, stories.
Mm-hmm. There are other stories. There's a really good book, if you're interested in this, maybe you're familiar with it. It's the ancient Near Eastern texts related to the Old Testament, and it's a collection. It's a huge volume that has narratives like this. It also has laws and so forth like that, and it's been collected because they are in some way related, or they have some kind of connection to material in the Hebrew Bible. There is a lot of material out there. This is one of the most interesting ones, actually, because it's preserved in many. There's three major versions of it. It's very well preserved, and because it seems to be a very important, pivotal myth. And actually, I think that it's one of the most important sort of underlying myths or narrative structures in both the Old Testament and New Testament. But I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Uh-huh. So was Marduk, he was the grandson of Apsu.
Right,
Apsu. But Tiamat. Does that make him also the grandson of Tiamat?
Right.
So he slew his grandmother.
Right, mm-hmm.
Well, and the other son had slew
his father.
Yeah,
it's kind of like Greek mythology, with Kronos, you know, killing all of his, eating all of his sons, and then finally Zeus escapes and to kill his father and assume the rule. And some people have associated these stories with changing changing cultures, you know, different waves and peoples conquering older indigenous gods and so forth.
Right. Did a female exist after that? A female goddess?
There are female goddesses, and some of them are important. There's Ishtar. I'm named after Ishtar. This is the goddess of love and war, Esther Ishtar, and her
love
sign
and
is
war.
Venus.
Okay.
Love and war. She's very violent. And she's never married, but she always has a lover. And she's an important goddess. So there are goddesses, but this is the great mother god. And it seems like a lot of mythology has a great mother god way back when.
Was she, since being a sea serpent, was she a dragon? Does that translate into a dragon or not?
It's kind of, we just know that she's related to the sea. I mean, the kind of the concept of sea monster, sea serpent, so, you know, those are English words, and she's seawater. She's the great deep. That's really the best translation for her, the great deep. Home, yeah, the great deep. So it's like the big abyss.
Mm-hmm. And then after she became... this bubble, or
this is her body. Mm-hmm. We live
and
in her body.
And then is she revered by the culture after that, or is it just is she taken for granted?
I think she's taken for granted. She's never mentioned again. This is the last time, she's hacked up and she's made into the world, and Marduk is the ruling god after that. She seems to be pretty well vanquished, and sort of now she's just a setting.
So the world becomes Tiamat's body becomes the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's her grandson that kills her.
And it's ruling.
Sort of a reversal of things.
Oh, how do you mean reversal?
Never mind.
Okay. I'll have to talk about that later. Any other comments or questions or anything? Now, if we go back to Psalm 89 one more time before we move on to some other examples. of the use of this imagery in the Old Testament, I find it interesting that at least in the first part of this psalm, you seem to have a similar kind of validation of military and political structures, because the God of David, he's putting David on the throne, and then this whole myth is recounted here as a legitimation of, you know, okay, I have the power to do this. I'm granting the power. I'm in power here. And so your throne, David, is going to last forever and so forth. So it seems to be, the use of it seems to be parallel here almost. It seems to be supporting a political state, a military state. David was the first Hebrew military leader that was able to defeat the Philistines and to unite a large portion of the area that became Israel and Judah. So, similar usage. But now, if you look, this is what becomes more interesting to me. If you look, starting with verse 39, you see a later addition to the psalm. Would somebody begin reading there? I don't know if we'll read the whole thing, but read a few verses anyway.
I will.
Thank you.
Thou hast renounced the covenant with thy servant. This is the RSV.
Thank you.
Thou hast defiled his crown in the dust. Thou hast breached all his walls. Thou hast laid his strongholds in ruins. All that pass by despoil him. He has become a scorn of his neighbors. Thou hast exalted the right hand of his foes. Thou hast made all his enemies rejoice. Yea, thou hast turned back the edge of his sword, and thou hast not made him stand in battle. Thou hast removed the scepter from his hand and cast his throne to the ground.
Thank you. That's you probably get the idea. There's been a military defeat. And most likely this is actually the defeat at the hand of the Babylonians, but a later incarnation of the Babylonian power. Not, this is the old Babylonian kingdom, and then there was a kind of a resurgency of power in later times. And so at around 587 or so, the Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians came in and they destroyed Jerusalem. They took all of the wealthy people, all the political leaders, all the educated people into captivity. And this last section then contains a record of that, and it's tagged on to the earlier part of the poem. And what I find interesting about this is that the other two examples that we're going to look at also, they don't use this image as legitimation of a strong military power, but it becomes used rather as an appeal for help in time of trouble. So instead of a statement by the strong, hey, we're strong because our God is the strongest and because our God is the most powerful in the world, has destroyed the sea monster, created the world and so forth and is ruling. Instead of that, you have an oppressed people saying, we can't do anything. And so, you know, we need some help. Where's some help? So let's look at a couple of these kinds of examples where this imagery is used by people during the Babylonian exile after they've been defeated and they're asking God for help. Let's look first at Psalm 74. Psalm 74:12-17 is what we'll be looking at. But the whole thing is it's a lament and an ask and a request for help. The first part talks about God's anger and recounts that the sanctuary's been destroyed. And that God's dwelling place has been dishonored and so forth, and there's no help. There's no prophets. Nobody knows how long this situation will last. In 11, it talks about, why do you hold back your right hand? Remember the imagery of the right hand. The right hand now, instead of being strong and forward, it seems to be behind God. It's weak. And so now we'll look at from 12 through 17, just to look more closely at another appearance of this narrative pattern. Would somebody read that? Want to?
But you, O God, are my king. From of old, you bring salvation upon the earth.
Once again, fighting with the sea, smashing the heads of the monsters, crushing the heads of Leviathan. Leviathan comes from a Hebrew word to mean twist, so it's like the coiled serpent. It's like a twisty serpent, often associated with the sea also. And then more water imagery here. I don't really know what to say about that, but then begins to say, talk about creation, the day and the night, and setting the orb in place, boundaries of earth, summer and winter, so you have the reference to creation again. So you see a lot of those themes repeated. But here it's not a statement of victory or of a statement that we're strong because this is the case, but it's reminding God, look, we know you are strong. This is the old mythic pattern. Can you revive? Can you do it again? Will you do it again? Because we need this again. We want a repetition. We want an end to the kinds of tumult and raging chaos, the kinds of uncontrollable violence, the things we can't control. We need somebody who can control them, and so it's a request, it's a prayer. One more. Let's look at Isaiah 51, and this also is another request for a repetition of this pattern of God's active intervention in both creation and in history here. Now, history in creating a new ordered place where people can live again safely. And the part that we'll look at is from 9 to 11. And once again, this is during the Babylonian exile, but Isaiah, 2 Isaiah, which starts at Isaiah 40, was writing toward the end of the Babylonian exile, so it was just before the people were coming back, and so he's asking for a new exodus, actually. Would somebody read that, please? Okay.
This is Revised Standard.
Revised Standard, thank you.
Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake, as in days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not thou that didst cut Rahab in pieces, that didst pierce the dragon? Was it not thou that didst dry up the sea, the waters of the great deep, that didst make the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to pass over? And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away.
Thank you. Second Isaiah is one of my favorite poets, and I think he writes beautifully. So here's an appeal for God to wake up and put on military garb and, O arm of the Lord. Once again, that image. The same, it's a repetition of the same pattern here. Awake as of days of old. Okay, we have the reference to Rahab, once again, and the dragon, the sea. But this is interesting because starting with 10, instead of a reference to a physical creation of the universe, you have a reference to the exodus, to the crossing of the sea. It was you that dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, that made the abysses of the sea a road the redeemed might walk. And so instead of a creation of the physical world, it's a creation of a new people. So Isaiah always takes old images, second Isaiah takes old images and uses them in beautiful ways. And he recalls a past time when God created a new people out of a slave people. And if you remember the story of the Exodus, they use that same imagery. That's why I think that this myth is one of the great underlying myths that just pops its head up once and again in the Old Testament. Because if you remember in the Exodus, in chapters 14 and 15 of Exodus, God splits the sea separates it, makes dry land, and then the people pass. And then once again, it starts raging, but the raging of the sea then is destructive of the enemies. So the Exodus story, too, contains motifs from this pattern, which may tell us that we shouldn't try to find where the place was that the sea was parted and so forth, because it seems to be more of a poetic or mythological statement of the creation of a new people rather than a historical event. Okay, so it refers to the Exodus, and then it asks for a new act like this. So let the ransom of the Lord return from Babylonian exile here, not out of Egypt, and come with shouting to Zion, and have joy and gladness, and let all sorrow and sighing flee. So here, in these last two examples anyway, this image of God as the warrior is an image of an advocate that people who are in deep trouble need. I'm going to move on to a couple of New Testament parallels, but any comments or questions or anything before we move on? Mm-hmm.
This is a common myth that's shared both by Judaism and or the Hebrew people and the other Near Eastern cultures. Why then does it go opposite directions?
Mm-hmm. Can you point out where you think it goes in opposite directions?
Well, I would say at the point of the monotheism. Mm-hmm. I would say at the point of idol worship. I would say at the point of the covenant, a covenant people.
Mm-hmm. That's very good. You pointed out that there are not only similarities, strong similarities in the structure of the myth, but also very strong differences. And I think by comparing the two and finding the differences, we can come to greater appreciation for the distinctiveness of the Israelite vision of who God is. And what's the reason for this split? Perhaps is, I don't know, revelation. I don't know, an insight, some kind of insight that
or perhaps
to the nature
really
of God.
Isn't a shared common myth.
Oh, you don't think it is? But you know, there's
just
so many.
Say,
okay.
Mm-hmm. Possibility exists. Mm-hmm. It could be I would see it possibly as even sometimes corruptions of things enter into it. I mean, you don't have necessarily a purity of a text always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that somehow the Israelites had to express their vision of who God was, and the material that was available was stories like this. So they took elements of the stories and reshaped them. And you're right, it is a different vision. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before you leave the Old Testament, one of the ongoing embarrassments in the Old Testament relates to God being an oriental warrior,
mm-hmm.
and utterly ruthless,
mm-hmm.
and countenancing genocide of conquered peoples.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to address that at all? It's something that gets shuffled under the table by both Jews and Christians.
I would really like it if you would raise that question again. Maybe we could have a discussion on that kind of issue at the end. I just have a couple of parallels, New Testament parallels, and then I'm going to open it up. I'm going to say, what are the dangers of this image? You know, that kind of thing. What are the advantages and so forth? So thank you very much.
Just one other before.
Sure.
I just noticed verse 12 in Isaiah 51 there has some images that really kind of were in last night's service.
Oh, good. Could
intentional
you?
Or?
Could you read that? No, not intentional.
I am He that comforts you. Who are you that you are afraid of man who dies, of the Son of Man who is made like grass?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that service. Yeah, that service was based on Isaiah 40 and 55, I believe. So that's 55. Well, now we don't have 40 or 55 here, but you know, Isaiah uses comfort. He uses the word comfort a lot. He uses grass imagery and so forth. So, yeah, good observation. So you already know the literary style of Second Isaiah. Okay, let me just mention a couple of uses of this imagery in the New Testament, and then I want to open this up for the last 15 minutes so people can talk about this imagery and its drawbacks, downfalls, values, and so forth. First of all, I want to mention the image of Jesus stilling the water. If you want to look at a text, if you look at Mark 4, 35 to 41, it's in all the synoptic gospels. It's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That's Mark 4, 35 to 41. And I think probably most people know the story, but perhaps it's not too long, so we can read it quickly. Do we have it? Okay.
On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let's go across to the other side." Leaving the crowd, they took him with them, just as he was in the boat. And other boats were with him, and a great storm of wind arose, and the waves beat into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. They woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care if we perish?" But he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." The wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you no faith?" They were filled with awe and said to one another, "Who then is this that even wind and sea obey him?"
Thanks. So if you read that in light of the other Old Testament images, you have Christ asleep, and then he awakes. They awaken him, as in Isaiah, and then he stills the water, and they ask, "Who is this?" Now, anybody reading that or hearing that story would immediately think of other episodes of stilling the water and would associate this power with the power of God. Okay, let's look at one other example of this use of the warrior imagery. It's a little bit different. It's in Paul. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 15, 20 forward. Now, Paul doesn't use the imagery of the sea, and he changes it from the Old Testament context of nations and national catastrophe and generalizes the battle, which Christ does. Would somebody read, starting with 1 Corinthians 15, 20 to 28? Well, yeah. No, just read to 27, that's fine. 20 to 27.
But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For as by a man came death, by a man has come also the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive. But each in his own order, Christ the first fruits, then at his coming those who belong to Christ. Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father, after destroying every rule and every authority and power. For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. For God has put all things in subjection under his feet. But when it says all things are put in subjection under him, it is plain that he is accepted who put all things under him.
Okay. All right, great. So you have the image of Christ doing battle with all principalities and rulers and so forth. And this is developed further by later theologians. For example, Irenaeus talks about why did Christ become a human being? Because we humans have lost life due to the serpent. Now the serpent connects in, that imagery of the serpent. And so Christ came to do battle with death, destroy sin, overcome death, and give life to man by doing battle with the serpent. And destroying the serpent, setting us free. So especially in the later. You have some seeds of it in Paul and the New Testament, but the later church fathers developed this imagery of Christ as doing battle with the serpent, defeating sin, death, and bringing life, liberating people and bringing life. Okay, so now I want to get to some discussion, because we don't only have 10 or 15 minutes here. But I do want to ask, as this image of the warrior moves forward into the 20th century, is it still a meaningful or powerful image? It's not, for example, on Holden's suggested list of names for God, which include searcher, blossom of all things, clown, gentler, gentle trickster, and so forth. Now, what are the dangers? We've already had one danger of this image, and general reactions. Would you want to open the discussion again with that?
Well, ethnic cleansing is something that's explicitly mandated in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
God punishes the Israelites when they spare even a few of the women from conquered cities,
mm-hmm.
and demands that they kill every last living thing in the conquered cities.
Right, the Amalekites are supposed to be completely wiped out.
They're not even to be saved in order to be given as sacrifices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that you've hit right on the nail the worst problem with this imagery, because it's used in the way that the Babylonians used it and in the way that Psalm 89 in its original coronation setting used it to legitimize military power. So if you have the power, then God's on your side, so everybody else is your enemy and you destroy them completely. Mm-hmm.
What strikes me though is that in our own churches across the United States, where you have this loving Jesus with children, his arms are open, we never see Jesus with a sword, yet we have no problem invading tons of countries and bombing people. Maybe if we had Jesus with a sword, maybe we'd be a little more peaceful and not have 100,000 people bombed in Iraq. I mean, the contradiction is so strong that here we have this loving, we talk about peace in a sense, but we do it through mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Last night's service, again, the story of Abraham appealing to God not to destroy the people in Sodom and Gomorrah, just a few good ones there. The power was still there, but the appeal from man asking God not to use it was what was different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, two things really struck me, at least two things, by listening to the conversation. One was the power of the metaphor of the deep, of the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, this was a metaphor that somehow held people over against just the awesome forces of life.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was how people, as you put it, utilized what was available in terms of the story milieu of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Took a hold of just the conversations that were going on and used them to really freight a new consciousness or a different grasp of life. And then the third thing that struck me was the sense that which finally is in charge is that which brings order into the chaos that the deep symbolizes. I don't know what all that means, but that really struck me powerfully listening to the conversation that you led and comments that were made.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of brings me back to where you were leading us to and raising the question of now, what for us today would be an equivalent way of beginning to address the same kinds of issues? What's the mythological milieu of our day? And what would be the equivalent for us of the metaphor of the deep in terms of just the awesome power that clearly mediated for people in those days? That's where
I'm. Have any suggestions?
I
was hoping you would come up with the answers. But yeah.
Well, as to what I appreciated was that in the story of Moses, that it instead of becoming, instead of the myth being external, it became, the people themselves. It became an internal, process of the people being saved. And it wasn't just the gods up in the sky or something that were being that were being affected by cosmic forces, but it was the people and the transformation of people into the people of God.
Mm-hmm. So you have this imagery being moved into the historical realm,
yeah,
where people are affected. I think that's one of the great innovations or the great contributions of the Hebrew imagination and their conception of God. Also, is you don't have this whole well-developed mythology. You have references to a mythological pattern, but there's always a relation to the human heart. Yeah.
Historical God,
right.
I thought it was a little too hassle to say that you shouldn't look for the Reed or Red Sea site because it was really talking about the allegorically about this mythology. The point is that whatever the mythology that they may have been familiar with, mm-hmm, they were interested in historical event where God had delivered his people and they faced their whole covenant and their whole sense of themselves of that,
mm-hmm,
episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a...
So you can't...
A difference.
...lose the history.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a combination of myth and concern for history that we don't have today, I think, or at least not in the same way. There were some, hi, back there.
Well, are you on the same topic?
Any topic. Choose a topic.
It ties in a little bit, I think, about the warrior business.
Yeah,
the
I wanted to get back to that.
I'm living sort of close to this stuff right now in Cyprus in the Middle East, and it strikes me that, and these things in the Old Testament bother me enormously, and they provide such food and fuel for people here and for people in Israel especially to act the same way as if they're still writing the Old Testament and putting God's will on it. But, so I have an enormous reaction against that. I want to say this is not important in the Bible. This is the human filter and all those kinds of things, and just not talk about it as part of our salvation, that image of God. But what strikes me is that our American experience can get us out of joint real fast, because what have we done? In 200 years, we've flooded over here into an enormous piece of real estate, sort of wiped out most of the people who were here before us, had a lot of space, a lot of resources, been able to attenuate the ethnic strife between us, and to get away from what has to be the norm of human history, which is to be in fear of the people who live over that mountain, who are gonna come over here and steal your things and perhaps kill some of you. That's been the norm in human life all through human history, and so for the Israelites to see God coming into that kind of a world, like you were saying, what are the images today, Jim? An image for God in that setting would certainly be the God who leads us in victory against unjust attack and against our neighbors who keep wailing on us. It would be no more of a sin of enculturation to do that to God than for us to do some of the things we do to God, where he's sort of a feel-good God, you know, he just patting you on the back ad infinitum, and we forget all about his judgment and some of the other things he's having to do here on this earth. So I find myself, you know, sort of thinking of a historical corrective that we may not be so conscious of. And I think if you looked at our reaction in the Gulf War, that's our equivalent of going next door and beating up the Bosnians or the Croatians just because we're Serbs. I don't think there's a whole lot of difference between us.
I think there is, though, because we didn't take their land. We didn't occupy their land.
Whose land?
The Iraqis. Okay.
Yeah, but that's even a finer twist to it. We
yeah,
just bombed the hell out of them.
That's a major difference. Where the Israelites, in fact, were recipients of God's mandate to go forth and take somebody else's land. Not only to take it, but to kill everybody who's there so they have room.
Well, but they wrote the book, so...
But they were told to do that, and they were punished. It was treated as a sin if they didn't do it.
They also wrote that part.
Only when they wrote God's book, did they remove by the
That's what the Old Testament is.
Right.
They wrote the book. But given that, you've got a big problem.
No, but the part that God wrote comes through real clearly to you, don't they?
A big part?
The parts that God wrote, so to speak.
You can't do that. That's not legitimate.
That is illegitimate. Let your heart witness to you.
You can't play games like that.
Well, come out to the Middle East and feel this stuff.
Exactly. This is a Middle Eastern document. It's a Middle Eastern warrior.
So we have two people, anyway, who would... Well, one person anyway who says this image is inappropriate. This morning, a couple of people had some interesting comments. They said this image is inappropriate for us. And they said this image is appropriate in South Africa when we say that the chaos that's being conquered is racism. And they said this image is appropriate if the monster that's being conquered is some other kind of injustice, and the people who need help cannot help themselves, and they need some kind of image that they are not alone and that there is a possibility for change. And I thought that was a very strong statement that I heard this morning that I agreed with, that depends on where you're standing vis-a-vis the metaphor and what you apply the different terms to. You know, if you say the enemy is the Amalekites, or the enemy is the Palestinians, or the enemy is the American Indians, or the enemy is, and we are on God's side, then that is a demonization, it seems to me, of the metaphor. So
you're saying that the warrior is the one who protects from injustice, and in that case, that would be the difference.
I would think that would be for me anyway, that would be a positive
usage. That makes me feel a little better, because I have a hard time with the Old Testament. I look at the New Testament, and some of those things have disturbed me for a long time, looking at that God as a warrior, wiping out people. It's a difficult thing to...
Well, we tend to individualize it so much, rather than keep it within a corporate context, too. So it becomes God waging my individual battles, and I think sometimes we push that too far.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's 10 o'clock. We'll go ahead, one more. You'll be our closing statement.
I was thinking of one verse out of the Gospel. Jesus says, "I have not come to bring peace, I have come to divide." Is that kind of a warrior image too? You know, mother against mother, son against son.
Yeah, that could be one of the images that was picked up in the later development of the image of Christ as the warrior.
Yeah. You know, I'm a World War II veteran, mm-hmm. and it bothers me when we are called, you know, when we are accused in this country of bashing other nations. Mm-hmm. Every nation that we have ever, like in World War II, I mean, if we had sat here on our hands and done nothing, we wouldn't be worshiping. We wouldn't have a Bible study today like we do, because we wouldn't be allowed to have it. Our pastors would not get in the pulpit without freedom and being able to preach the gospel. And what did we do with the nations that we defeated? I mean, look what Germany is today and what Japan is today. I mean, we're not, and what did the Russians do? Look at East Germany before they came. So we have never taken over a nation without, except we have left them for themselves, but we have rebuilt them. And I don't think, and there's a lot of Christian people, including myself, that fought World War II, and I just don't feel that it's right for us to say that, just like Iraq, the reason we went into Iraq is because of tyranny in Iraq, and if we hadn't done anything there, then the whole Middle East would be, and eventually the whole world would be taken over. We're trying to protect this world from tyranny, and so I feel about it.
Boy, this is a whole other session. Yeah, the whole attitude of Christians towards war raises a very good.
And I don't. I'm not saying we're perfect. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that. We've done a lot of things that are wrong mm-hmm. too. But I think I think God has blessed this nation a lot.
Yeah. Thank you for your statement. Okay, 10 o'clock. Let's continue if you want to discuss more out by coffee. All right, thank you. Tomorrow, God is mother.